Well, good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the latest in our series of European lectures, which are organized by the European Institute in the LSE. We have had rather a French theme this term. We had my homologue, my opposite number, Richard Descoings from Sciences Po, who we asked to answer the question, France and Europe, the end of the affair. The answer, Monsieur le Président, was peut-être. We then had Pierre Moscovici with a perspective from the Socialist Party, and we are hugely honored this evening to have former President Giscard d'Estaing. Now, speakers who begin by saying that this evening's lecturer needs no introduction usually go on to read out a CV beginning with École Primaire and onwards. But I will not do that. I will simply note that the President was Finance Minister for many years before he became President. He became President in 1974. In that year, Mr. President, we actually did meet. Though, strangely enough, he can't remember it. I actually was in the I was in the embassy in Paris then as the ambassador's private secretary, and I took a delegation of British students to the Élysée. I now can't remember why I did that, but I remember that you thought I was one of the students, which I was quite quite offended by at the time, I have to say. But, of course, the particular role in which, from which, if you like, he is speaking to us this evening is that, of course, he was appointed to be president of the Convention on the Future of Europe, which led to the constitutional treaty, and the aftermath is what we're going to hear about this evening. I did, however, notice in reading the CV that one honor was bestowed on you in 2003 when you became member of the Académie Française. But I am told that you have a special dispensation from the Academy which is allowing you to speak to us in English this evening. So we're hugely looking forward to what you have to say, and I ask you all to welcome President Giscard d'Estaing. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, for your introduction, and ladies and gentlemen, and dear students. Just one word about what you just said about the Académie Française. As you know, I will not enter into details, but when you are a member of the Academy, you become immortal. Yes. Well, which go beyond what you do about retirement age. And I received a comment by a Belgian who is a comic man. And he said to me, to be immortal, you need to have a good constitution. Well, I'm very pleased and honored to address this audience tonight. Thank you for organizing, with the help of your assistants, this meeting. I know the reputation of your school, which makes it one of the best, and probably the best one in Europe. I have no experience of it, because even though I went through several highly rated institutions, I never attended a course here. So I got this impression of your school by hearsay, let's say by family hearsay. I am supposed tonight or this to speak about the political future of Europe. I will not express myself as a Frenchman to avoid some forms of prejudice. I will speak as a European, which I became after touring the European capital during the 2 years of the convention, and speaking as a European that will lay me open, I am afraid, to a worse sort of prejudice. If there is something that Europe will never suffer from, it is a lack of speeches. Europe, which is sometimes deprived of snow or water, is flooded by an extravagant flow of European lectures. These lectures can be classified in two groups. The first is composed of speakers proposing what the Union of Europe should become, what the goals of the European Union really are. The second group include the lecturers who explain why these goals are impossible to reach, giving the arguments for this impossibility. And what is really fascinating is the way some people make speeches falling successively into the two groups, taking the precaution of leaving a suitable amount of time between them. To avoid adding to this monumental flood, I will try tonight to limit myself to some simple observations and to very few recommendations. The first observation is that there are certainly some good arguments in favor of a European political union. They can be disputed, but it is difficult to ignore them. These arguments have evolved with time, because the process started now, as you know, more than 50 years ago. At the beginning, it was very simple. It was to put an end to the bloody folly of the wars, which last century twice devastated Europe, and which were very costly for the British people and for the French people. And now it's new, it's different, because the first goal is achieved. We have eliminated the notion of war between European nations. No one, even the most extravagant political leaders we may have, are suggesting something of this sort. So now it's something new. And the rationale for the European Union is to adjust us to the scale of the new world. This new world, pushed up by the extraordinary demographic upsurge of the last 150 years, it's really a new world, is composed of countries or group of countries which have a continental dimension and a continental population. Europe remains, curiously, except for Central America, the most divided continent. To put it simply, the contemporary argument for the political union of Europe is that when divided, we are too small. Whatever your claims, whatever your pretenses to influence the future course of the world or to express our own interests. The second point that one must keep in mind in that this continent building, I love this expression. The Americans, when they have some of their contemporary political action, speak of nation building. But we are the only one in the world for the moment to embark in a continent building. It is a historical process. It's not a political short-term process. It cannot be analyzed or conducted with short-term evaluation. And the time scale for continent building is more one of generations or decades than of years, or even less, 6 month period. The present twice yearly rotation of the presidency, for instance, is totally inadequate for building a strong political union of Europe. Ah, the British people, I know that the British people are here a minority, which is a very sympathetic minority, so I want to address them a little. Are the British people here aware that under the existing rules, Britain will not exercise the presidency of the Union again for another 13 years? Third point, the European debate put on stage not only two groups of actors, the government of the nation states and the European Union, but really three groups, but one is ignored. It is the third group is the people of Europe. So you have three actors, the people of Europe which stay mute, the government who speak in the behalf of the people of Europe, and the institution of the European Union. And the government, when they interpret the point of view of the people, frequently put their own slant on it. So you only hear in the debate the point of view of two groups, and not of the third one, which are the people. The only way we get some information about the people's judgment and aspiration is by polls, sometimes. And you should study and review with great care what is published, the Euro polling system, which is a very good one, and which gives indication we are more accurate and giving more information than what is given by the government. For instance, who tells the British people that at this moment, 14 countries out of 25, which makes by quick calculation 56%, have already ratified the Constitutional Treaty? People believe that no one did it. And in France, the government and, alas, most of the political leaders interpret the no to the referendum of last May as a no to Europe. Although the political leadership of France at that time had a much lower rating than the Constitutional Treaty itself, and probably received a broader slice of the no vote than Europe did. Also, when public opinion is dissatisfied with something, national governments are quick to put the blame on Europe, even when Europe has no competence to address the issue. You have a very simple and daily case, which is the problem of employment. And people say, and people write, that Europe is not doing enough. Europe has no competence to address the employment issue. All the competence remains in the hands of the national government and states. But, of course, the public opinion do not realize this. Fourth point, the political union of Europe, the process, is not a circle like the Slavic rhetoric, which goes back again to the same point from time to time. It's a trajectory starting from a point towards a final goal. This trajectory may take time, may face new obstacles, but it is a waste of time and energy to keep on reopening all the time the initial debate. The ultimate goal of the political union of Europe is to give Europe the institutional framework which will enable it to carry out common policies at the European level. There is a specific example, for instance, in an article, which is Article B of the 1991 Treaty of the European Union called the Maastricht Treaty, which Britain signed. You have this text. The Union shall set itself the following objectives: to assert its identity on the international scene, in particular through the implementation of a common foreign and security policy, including the eventual framing of a common defense policy, which might in time lead to a common defense. So the goals, this is now all of 16 years, the goals are very well defined. It's time, it's not a matter of debating what we want to do, but of determining how to do it. We must move from the what to the how. The brilliant British Prime Minister, which we met frequently with John Kerr during the process of writing the Constitution, was moving away from the intentions of the Founding Fathers when he said this. He said, "The vision is the one I share with Europe founders, an ever closer union of nation states, cooperating as of sovereign right where it is in their interest to do so." This is not what the Founding Fathers proposed. Cooperating as of sovereign right, where it is in their national interest, would be a backwards step. It will bring us back to what we did with some success in the past, and for instance, with the Entente Cordiale you commemorated a few months ago. The founding declaration, which is a large text, and I invite you, students or professors, I have no authority to invite the professors, the students, elites, to go back to the text, because people are speaking all the time in sort of vague knowledge of the realities. The texts are always very informative. And the text of May 9, 1950, which is the basic text for the foundation of the European Union, the declaration talks of the realization of the first concrete foundation of a European federation. Of course, the vocabulary has changed to address a British concern, and we accept not to use anymore the term federation. But the goal is still the same, the first stage of Europe's political union. So the aim is no longer for cooperation, but for establish a common organization with the institutions necessary to implement common policies in the spheres in which these have been decided. I will go back to this point at the end. My final observation, which is very important, is that no one is compelled to be part of Europe's political union. There were a campaign in the last years in the press, in the international press, sometimes in the US, that the European Union was a sort of jail in which unhappily people were trapped and they couldn't go out. And they wished to leave if they could. But the politicians were so clever, prevent them from doing so. And every country which has joined, who will join the European Union, has done it at its own request, often an insistent one. None of us criticized Norway or Switzerland for not belonging to the European Union. No one on the European continent criticizes Britain, Sweden, or Denmark for not adopting the euro. To underline this freedom of choice, we deliberately included in the treaty in Article 60, which provides for every member state the possibility of voluntarily withdrawing from the EU. So the political union is not a jail. It is a free choice. But if this choice is made, it must be effective. And I should now like to talk a little about the path with which the constitutional treaty has taken. This treaty, when you hear people or when you read the document, it seems to be a sort of fantasy, a lunatic creation by some demoniac thinker. Yes. And sometimes some of these brilliant responsibilities are attributed to me, but it's much more modest. This treaty was born of a request, even a genuine order, en français, une commande. It wasn't drawn up on the spur of the moment. The Open Convention was established in December 2001, already 4 years ago, by the Laeken European Council, on which sat all the head of states and government. So all of them were in charge at this moment, decided to establish the European Convention. The Council ordered the Convention to come up with a proposed reform, which had become essential because of the defective operation of the European system. What is known as the Laeken Declaration, probably you heard of it, lists all the faults to be corrected. The delimitation of the powers between the European Union and the member states, simplification of the rules and procedures, respect for the subsidiarity principle, and the role of national parliaments. We dealt with all these points with the convention members drawn from 25 member states. It was a painstaking and collective effort. Tony Blair was good enough to mention lately my brilliance in negotiating the solution. But this kind remark came because he was giving his speech on my birthday. My role was more one of diligence, assisted by the outstanding then John Kerr, now Lord Kerr, the convention's Secretary General, who is in this room. And may I tell him that I always wondered, if it was better to have John knighted and the Constitution rejected, or to have the Constitution adopted and John remaining John. I leave you the choice. So with his precious help, we presented a draft, which I took to the Thessaloniki European Council on June 20, 2003. And the council was not very flattering. It described it as a good starting basis. Then they worked on it for a year, for a period of 12 months, through discussion between the government, first under an Italian presidency, and then the Irish presidency. So the negotiation between government and the revision of the draft have already taken place. And the European Council finally adopted the draft unanimously on June 18, 2004. Shortly before that, on the 20th of April of that year, the British Prime Minister had announced in the House of Commons that the British people would decide by referendum on the constitutional treaty. And he said to the House, it is time to resolve once and for all whether this country, Britain, wants to be at the center and heart of European decision making or not. The fact that he was thus embarking on the procedure for ratifying by referendum certainly showed that he intended defending the text, deemed in conformity with Britain's interest. In his view, it was well balanced and never crossed any of the red lines set out by the British delegation. Probably you have forget this is in the past now, but during the year 2002-2003, there were frequent allusions in the press of the red lines, which were very important safeguards for Britain. All non-red lines have been crossed by this text. Britain, we thought at that time, would be the last one to decide whether or not to ratify the treaty after she had held a general election. But since the no vote of the French, things need to be clarified. The ratification process began satisfactorily. In Spain, the first country to hold a referendum, the treaty was approved by a majority of over 70% of the voters. And then other ratifications followed in Western and Eastern Europe, in Germany, Hungary, Austria, Italy, and in the Baltic countries. But the progress of the constitutional treaty was called into question by two events, the no votes of the French and Dutch electors, and the return of the British uncertainties. First, let me be clear about this. The rejection of the constitutional treaty in France was a mistake which will have to be corrected. What the mistake? This mistake due to the overcomplicated presentation of the draft. I insisted to have a much more simple document sent to the voters. At a time when politicians were highly unpopular, the spring of 2003. It doesn't much matter. Everyone has accepted the democratic verdict, whatever their regrets. But the main victim has been a treaty which, according to the opinion polls, the French were not against. At a time where second chances are the order of the day, the constitutional treaty will have to be given its second chance. When? When France has completed their great electoral debate with the presidential and parliamentary elections, which are due to be held in a 14-month time now, in spring 2007. And how? By refocusing the debate on the only genuinely constitutional part, that is to say, the first part, and the Charter of Fundamental Rights demanded by the European left, neither of which have given rise to much protest. Then the third part, which is more technical, the part which describes the existing policies of the Union, could follow a parliamentary route which is far better suited to its legal nature. Now, the return of the British uncertainties is more complex and take us into the realm of contradictions. The new line heard here in the European debate makes me think of the famous sophist Gorgias. I don't know if you are familiar with Gorgias. It doesn't seem to look like it. Gorgias, he was a famous man in the 4th century BC who developed the theory of sophism. And there was a famous sophism, you remember, all students know that. I will say it in French. Tous les Crétois sont menteurs. Gorgias est menteur, donc Gorgias est crétois. Alors, the new sophism here is the detective functioning of the European institutions produces bad results. One. European citizens don't like Europe because of its bad results. And third, let's get Europe loved by its citizens so they can agree to reform institutions. Gorgias would be delighted. Everyone senses that this is a dead end. Because how can you make lovable a system which is underperforming its tasks? It's absolutely impossible. The British Prime Minister recently, as did 2 years before, the Danish Prime Minister also said, a European Union, it's a quotation of what Mr. Blair said in the Frankfurter Allgemeine Zeitung a few days ago. He said, a European Union of 25 cannot function properly with today's rule of governance. Having spent 6 months as EU president, I am a good witness to that. So if we wait for the Europeans to love Europe before we can reform its institutions, we'll stay for a long time with an ungovernable system. So let's try and go back and get back to the normal trajectory of reform. Let's reform what has to be reformed by now in the constitutional treaty so that we can get better results, a clearer Europe, an identification of the actors, and so a satisfaction to the European public. And so here we get back to the idea of James Madison, who said, the role of constitution is not to decide the outcome of debates, but to establish institutions which enable debates to take place efficiently and democratically. And then Georgia's sophism becomes, European institutions are producing bad results. Europeans don't like Europe because of its bad results. Let's reform the institutions so that the Europeans can love Europe. We should seize on one encouraging development, the determination of three founding states, Germany, Belgium, and Luxembourg, and also today the Austrian presidency, to complete the process of approving the constitutional treaty. The two major parties in the German government coalition, that is the CDU-CSU and the SPD, have included this in their agreement for the Grand Coalition. I quote, "We support the treaty establishing a constitution for Europe. It contains some important progress. We will commit ourselves firmly in favor of pressing for a continuation of the process of ratifying this treaty during the first half of 2006 and inject new impetus into it during our presidency in 2007. So the biggest, Germany, the smallest, Luxembourg, agree to insist upon the completion of the ratifying process. Let me emphasize now, to keep enough time for the questions, one point which seems to be fundamental for Britain. The political union we are proposing rests on the principle of attribution of powers. Well, it's rather technical, you'll say, for but you are experts, students of very high level, professor of a still higher level, so you are familiar with this. Attribution of powers. It is an essential point. In our first draft, we didn't mention it so clearly. And it is at the British insistence that we said that the system functions on the basis of attribution of powers, subsidiarity, and proportionality. And I am amazed it isn't more often picked up on. The EU can exercise only those powers which member states attribute to it, and they attribute it unanimously. It is an essential safeguard for Britain, as it is also for France and all our partners. This attribution principle could even provide a way for countries wishing to opt out of certain attributed competences. This is what we decided to do, and I remember this well, regarding monetary union. You are certainly informed that Britain is a part of the European monetary system, but benefits from an opt-out regarding the adoption of the euro, an opt-out which is repeated in the time. If we use it for the Constitution, the system would become more complicated, but I think it would remain manageable. And this attribution principle, that Europe does only, has only the competences that we attribute to it, protect us, prevent us ending up with a situation no one wants, of a European power omnipresent in every social and cultural aspect of our daily lives. What we want, in fact, is a political union to safeguard more effectively our identity and role in tomorrow's world. A political union to manage jointly what we cannot longer have the means to manage on our own. And for the rest, let's safeguard our long history, which will continue with due regard for our motto, United in Diversity. The adoption of the Constitutional Treaty, and this is my end, will not be enough, of course, to complete Europe's political union. A great deal will still have to be done and should be studied by academic institutions. I will quote 4 points. First, to finalize a mechanism for selecting and proposing candidates for top European Union posts. Of course, these posts are, the Council will elect them, but the election should be preceded by a search and a profile of the candidates. Then the Council would choose between these candidates instead of confining itself to choosing one of their own members. Organizing the way 20 or 27 members Council should work. They cannot work without an organization. They do not function at this moment. They can neither discuss nor decide. And you can ask to everyone what on this meeting. How should that be structured? We debated it, but we thought it was not a constitutional element by rotating vice president or by the creation of a bureau. Prepare for the creation of a foreign policy think tank, because there will be a foreign secretary, according to the treaty, but he needs to have with him a strong think tank working under him and having liaison with national foreign ministries. And carefully prepare a realistic timetable and binding commitment with a view to establish the European Political Union for the eventual next enlargements, bringing in states located on the European continent. So there will be a lot to do to build the political union. We'll need you. And this is my end. Dear students, I would like to conclude by addressing some remarks more specifically to you. Nothing of great value has ever been built without enthusiasm. The political union of Europe must not be an arrangement or a weed conceived for the benefit of a few insiders. It is a great task which needs popular support, the support of each and every one of you. I'm not asking you to be less British, less French, less Dutch, less German, Italian, or Spanish. I am asking you to feel more European, to fill your lungs with oxygen, as we do when we're in the mountains, to feel more alert, livelier, bolder. You will see the world from a higher vantage point. I urge you to have confidence in your political future. Far from the sniggering of the skeptics, because that way you will bring greatness into your lives. Thank you.
Thank you very much, President, for that fascinating and, in conclusion, inspiring address. I can see that your request for people to construct a foreign policy think tank was creating gleam in the eye of some of our faculty. Think tank, we of course call it here a char à penser, which now I'm going to take questions from everybody except Lord John Kerr. Not because he has had too much adulation already or because of his role as Secretary of the Convention, but because of his role on the governing body of Imperial College, and therefore it would be very unpopular with my students if I allowed you to speak. But everybody else may ask a question. If you're French or Dutch, you may also say how you voted in the referendum if you wish, but you don't need to. There are microphones, and I'd like people to say who they are and where they're from as they ask their questions. And so, who is going to be the first? Yes, in the back, second row from the back there. Thank you.
My name is Jia Bo Liu. I'm a doctoral student in law here. I heard from some commentators say that countries in Europe want to establish political union, not because you have common enemies, but because you have common friends, the United States. I just wonder, Mr. President, do you support or oppose this view? Thank you.
Well, it's not a question, it is rather an affirmation. No. The first part of your question is very true. We are not trying to unite because we have by now a common enemy. We haven't a common enemy. We haven't. It's new. We had it me all along our history. Now, no. We are uniting, trying to unite, to change our dimension, which is something more daring. It's a little bit what the American colonies also did in their way. Well, it's not identical, and all this. But you know what they started, the American colony, the first responsibility they created was the common foreign policy. They started by that because they wanted to be united to address the others. At the time, the others were first, of course, the British Crown, but also European powers and all that. When you look at what's happening in the world by now, when there are disputes, for instance, in terms of trade, you see that we are united for international trade. We have a federal system for handling international trade. We have a single representative, the clever, the former was the clever also, and they express the common point of view of Europe, and they are listened to. If you had 25 speakers speaking on this subject, no one will listen, and after the fifth one, everyone will have forgotten what the first one has said. So to negotiate, we need to have some common structure. So the question of the US, we must not have an obsession of that. Of course, it's a very, very important power, rather similar in value, culture, history to us. But we have also some form of identity. We are not enemies, of course, it's very clear. We are partners, it's also very clear. But we may have some attitudes, some postures, which might be different. For instance, we put the respect of international law very high. All the Europeans, the Americans less. It's not a critique, no. Is due to their history. They never ratified binding treaty. They were always adamant to do that. And we are, on the contrary, very attached to international law. we have not anymore any sort of culture of imperialism. We have not the idea to dictate what countries must become in terms of political institution, political life. It's finished. We did it with success or failures in the 18th and 19th century. It's over. No one proposes it. So we can be partners. We will never be enemies. But we may have different approaches on certain global international issues. And I think it's good for both. It's good for the US. When you look at history, a lonely power is always in some form of danger. And for us to be cut from a very important and decisive power would be also very imprudent. So we need to have this mutual partnership, but on a basis in which everyone brings its own system of value and interest.
There was somebody up here, yes, the second row near the front there. Oh, yeah, near the front. You can be next. He caught my eye first.
My name is Tolkien Sultanov. I'm a student at London School of Economics. Thank you for your speech. I just had a question. You raised the issues of integration in European Union, although I think the economic problems of European Union also underlies as a major concern. What do you think that about European taxation system? How do you think this will influence the integration?
It's not an easy question because one must be very precise on that. We have some rules. These rules are into the treaties. The taxation system on people and companies is not a European competence. We have no competence. It means the income tax, the death duties, capital gain, nothing to say. On the other hand, we have a single market. So this market might be affected by certain fiscal discrepancies, and we must avoid them. And that is a legal base for Europe. So the British people, for instance, must not be afraid by the argument your taxes will be decided by the horrible commission. No, there's no need to do that. To what extent must we go to have some form of harmonization concerning competition? That's the point. Certain taxes are very technical, you know, some duties on certain products. Well, they are harmonized. We have no more great problem there. Then the question of the VAT. Because the VAT applies to different products. When it is a product of the market, we shouldn't have too high a difference between the VAT rate to avoid what people call tax shopping. Cross the border to buy on the other side because they gain 5% or 7%. So we need to have not the same rate, but a rather narrow band of rates, which we have. It's just above 50. So you can go to 20, 18, 19, so on. And no one objects. The difficulty is for the goods which are not sold on the market, but which are services. Because some of these services could be cross-bordering, and some others, no. If they are absolutely local, like a hairdresser or a small cafe or that one. It's strictly national competence. But in the modern society, you have some services which may be used crossing the border. You may choose between advisors, companies, experts. And then you need to have some harmonization. I will not go too much into detail, but it's very interesting to take the French case, because French create a lot of problems on that part. They are accustomed to do. It's because the decision which was taken in 1998 was to say for services you can have exemptions for three groups and you will choose yourself the group you want. There was a list of seven groups established by the Commission and each country have chosen and they apply a lower rate. For instance, Italy and Spain put on this list the restaurant, food, restaurant, tourism, all that. France did not. We prefer to use it for restoration of building, working into the building industry, social services for the aging or deprived people, and very strangely, the glass cleaning in the streets. It's a reason for which we are very clean. And we didn't ask for tourism. We did not. And 2 years later, in an electoral campaign, one candidate said, we will ask it for tourism. But it was impossible. It has been accepted by France. That could have done like Italian, Spanish. So you may have like this some limited point of friction. But the base will remain that taxation as such is a national responsibility. Only the argument of when taxation directly distorts competition, you can have some system of harmonization.
I can't personally see any problem with a harmonised tax on hairdressers, but there, yeah, good, that's it.
Bonjour, Monsieur le Président. Je suis Raphaël Lépine, le petit-fils du professeur Pierre Lépine et le fils de Michel Gay Lépine, qui a travaillé pour vous pendant 7 ans à l'Élysée, quand vous étiez président.
Il aurait dû travailler pendant 7 ans.
My question to you is, and thank you for a great speech, can you give us your predictions for the elections coming up next year in France and the implications for your project for Europe, what it would mean to the European Constitution, whoever wins the elections next year? Thank you.
Well, up to now, in the debate about the political future of France, the question of Europe is not on the stage. It's very little debate on that up to now. You have two key questions. One is security, and the other one is employment and growth. Are the two issues are debated, and which probably at this moment would make the difference. But as you know, in France and many European countries now and in the world, elections are won by a very slim majority. 51 against 49, 52 against 48, all that. And it may happen that in next year, the European issue comes into the debate. Possible. I hope so. Because it will oblige the contenders to express some views, some plans, some intentions concerning Europe. What they want to, at this moment, obviously, the position is to believe that Europe is only a way to lose support. Because if you go too far, you lose support. If you don't go far enough, you lose other support. And so you avoid the topic. But there will be events. You will have the German presidency before the French election. And the German presidency will be very active at proposing that we conclude. So we have to answer. If we say nothing about it, you cannot insist on the Franco-German understanding. So So all these questions will probably surface. At the moment, they are not really into the debate, and there is no major difference in what is said by the prospective candidates, but I hope and I wish that this will change before the end of the debate.
Thank you. Yeah, let's take, I think the third row here caught my eye first.
Thank you. My name is Maria Muriel Sanchez, and I am Spanish, and I am working as a solicitor in the UK, dealing with immigration and asylum. My question is, where is the place of minorities within the European Union in the Constitution? For example, where is the place of the aspirations of some Scottish nationalists to have an independent country, or the aspirations of Catalans and Basque, to name a few?
The Constitution by its name is a treaty. Treaties are signed by government. So this treaty needs to be signed by the Spanish government. And if the proposals would be considered as dangerous or extremes by the Spanish government, he will refuse. John Rayman certainly, as I do, at the end, durcissement, the hardening of the Spanish position on certain points. But what we do in the Constitution is to recognize the rights of the minorities formally. We don't say how they should be organized. This remains a responsibility of the member states. But a minority cannot be mistreated, cannot be persecuted, of course, and all that. And this applies to all minorities, for instance, to minorities in Spain. We couldn't go further, but we have enshrined into the text the existence of rights of the political minorities.
Next. Yes, one down here, man with a red pullover. Yeah.
Thank you. Monsieur le Président. Mr. Jacques Delors.
Sorry, you didn't give your name.
Roger Kirkham, member of the public. Thank you for your lectures. Thank you. Monsieur le Président, thank you very much for your lecture. Jacques Delors said in January that, and I quote, "Perhaps I agree with Madame Thatcher, perhaps Europe is better off without the United Kingdom." Can I ask your response to that observation?
That's a yes.
It would be easier. Clearly, yes. But it will be imperfect. It will be easier because the point is that the British have not made their choice. In fact, their history, if you look at history, because it's long-term events, there was a dream for the British that thought that maybe there could be a sort of Anglo-Saxon empire. Churchill, at the end of the war, for instance, expressed this view. He said what is important in the Second World War, that he created between the United States and Britain a new bond. And when Churchill delivered his famous speech in Zurich. In this speech, the UK was not a member of the European Union. They were watching from outside. So the choice has not been made. Very curious. And if I was a Briton, I don't know what my choice would be. There is an idea or a dream or a nostalgia that there could be some special relationship between the English-speaking big country, the US and UK. And of course, it is in contradiction with the European Union process, because the European Union process is absorbing a little. You get into it, and it creates constraints, regulations, a bit, and all the what. So the Britons have not made their choice. But what they have in mind is very strange. Because at the same time, they're embarrassed with the European Union. They're embarrassed, and probably negative at the moment. But they don't accept to leave. If there was just a proposal to say, well, it's okay, we'll finish with the system, let's get out of the European Union, there would be 70% of no. So we're in a transition period for Britain. For how long? Difficult to say. And it is complicated because the main parties in Britain change their position. The party which is in opposition is usually anti-European. It was the case of the Labour when the Conservatives were in power. I remember very well the position of the Labour Party under Mr. Wilson at the beginning of his term. And now it's a reverse. The Tories seem to be more, a little less personal, more anti-European than the Labour is. So it indicates that there is not a clear choice up to now, which is, after all, normal. What is not good is to present it by the British side as a way to prevent the other to organize themselves. If they want to organize themselves, let them do it. And Britain will decide at the proper moment under what form to join. If you listen to my small speech, we're kind enough to applaud, which is an indication that you heard some part of it. just an indication. there was a very subtle hint, which is to say, we have the principle of attribution, which is enshrined in the Article 1 of the treaty. Europe are the competence that is attributed to it. You could imagine that Britain, after having ratified the treaty, said, well, there is certain competence we don't want to attribute to the Union. Like, for instance, the Euro, that was the case. And it will be difficult how to handle this technically in European Parliament, in the European Council. It's not very easy, but it can be done. And I think it's probably the way to progress. Because, of course, if we push the British to a final position in which they accept everything, or they reject everything, it will be very uncomfortable for them. And the choice probably will not be very significant, because they don't want either to accept it or to leave the system. So that is my view. And I don't like the idea that we eliminate countries. This famous European with two speed and all that means are the good one, and the bad one, the big one, and the small one. It's very unpleasant. When you belong to a group, you belong to the group. The group is as it is. You have big people, strong people, rich people, poor people. It's like it is. But you can always have the posture that if one wants to take a special position, it should probably be able to do so. And so the line in the next 2 years will be to try to have the treaty ratified by almost everyone, including France. So it will be 23 countries, with Poland and Great Britain being in a special position probably. And then ask to the British, what do you want? What do you want? Do you want to be out of the system? Or do you want to be into the system with a special status? What status? Please make your proposal, and we will open a debate on that.
Thank you. There's one right at the back there. Yeah.
Thank you. My name's Alistair Cullen. I'm a member of the public as well. I think I didn't get into the LSE, but
try Imperial.
No, if you can't have the best, you know. But anyway, I wonder if I could reply briefly to Mr. President's comments on Britain's view. I wonder if it is maybe explained by the fact that when we walk around London every day and in this room we see all the benefits perhaps that we have had from joining in terms of the free movement of people and also goods and capital, and it's provided us with colleagues and friends and in some one or two cases wives and girlfriends of that we wouldn't maybe have had otherwise. But perhaps we see less future and maybe less need for his vision of the way that Europe wants to go. And I wonder if he mentions that perhaps we need for European people to love Europe a little bit more. Maybe if when there were, does he think that when there were referendums and we vote narrowly in favour, then that's a historic step forward. And when we vote narrowly against, then we have made a foolish error for which we must repent at the earliest date. Does he think if that changed, then we might be a little bit more inclined to love Europe?
Well, first of all, everyone makes mistakes. I do. I did. You do. You will. Group of people can make mistakes. Error of judgment, ignorance, lack of information. The vote in France was confused, because many people were not able to read the text because it was too long. It was honestly ridiculous to send the third part to the voters. Ridiculous. They couldn't read it. And if they read it, it was threatening, because you have paragraphs of the social policy or the employment policy or education. And when people look at that, they think, well, must be something hidden in that confusion, is dangerous. So it was a mistake. Second, France has no tradition of referendum. The Swiss have a long tradition. They know how to vote in referendum. They vote for or against a proposal. They do it, and they do it their own way. In France, no. When you have a referendum, near the end, it's for or against the political power in place. At the end, if they're satisfied with the political power, with the government, they vote yes. If they are dissatisfied, they vote no, whatever the question is. So the process was not adapted, in fact, to the issue, and we were, all of us, because I shared the responsibility, it was a mistake to use the referendum process. But when you make a mistake, you can correct it. What is this sort of harshness who say you can never correct your fault? Well, you can. The Irish voted once, no. And a year later, yes. The Danes voted once, no. And a year later, yes. So the French people can do it. Yes. And they can do it with a good conscience. But what I say is, you must avoid, because the French are proud people, you must not put them in a situation in which they have said no, and you say to the same people, well, it is the same question, you will say yes. No, say no what. So we must change a little the process. And for instance, ask questions only on the constitutional matters, which are very simple, for other things. And the Bill of Rights, I remind you of the fact that in the US, for instance, Jefferson accepted to support the Constitution only because there was a Bill of Rights. And we have put a Bill of Rights, which is the second part of the Constitution, so if we present this package, the Constitution and the Bill of Rights, I think it will be different, and most of the argument would be evacuated. So there is a possibility of doing so. It's too early. You need to let people rest and think again about the issue and observe the nonsense when we are. Before coming here, I watched the TV. There was no more ice skating. And there were political news which are not as entertaining, I must say. And there was an information telling on the British TV, if a certain general, a certain general, that is arrested, then the road will be open for Serbian entry into the EU. Oh. So it means that we will have one more commissioner, one more rotating president from the former Yugoslav Republic. We will have three now, four commissioners, and one British. And you say it's already too complicated, the bureaucracy. You will have a new layer of bureaucracy in the bureaucratic system. So it indicates that all this deserves attention and thinking. And I hope and I believe really that if there is a good presentation to the French people and telling them that, well, they voted like they wanted to vote, but first the context has changed, then some of what they express has been taken into consideration, into account, probably they will vote yes. Because when you look at the trend of the polls, until February 2004, the yes was always above 60%. So it indicates that it was not a rejection of the text. In fact, it was an expression of political dissatisfaction concerning also the text, but several other factors.
Thank you. We've not got a lot more time, so I'm going to take two or three more. Maybe we'll take three questions together, yes. And then we'll have a woman in the middle there in the red. Down third row.
Did you pass it down to her?
You don't need to take it off.
Oh, my God. Thank you very much. My name is Magda Urbanek, and I'm a student from Queen Mary, originally Polish. I would like to ask you, President, whether you envisage the possibility of varied forms of membership in the European Union, whether it would be a good remedy for the next applicant countries to allow for different, not full membership in the European Union. And additionally, I would like to ask you, ask your opinion on the concept of flexibility. How does this concept of flexibility fits in your vision of political future for Europe?
Thank you. And there's another one just over there. Yeah. You. Flexible membership. Do you think that's a good idea?
Hello, my name is Sotiris Zartaloudis. I'm from Greece and I'm a student of the European Institute of LSE. And I would like to ask you, Mr. President, what are your, in your opinion, the implications of Turkey's EU membership to the political future of Europe? Thank you.
Thank you. And one here at the front row here. Actually, well, front row here, I've seen first. I'm sorry, I know there are more people I can't take, but you'll just have to accept my arbitrary judgments here.
Mr. President, I very much enjoyed your speech, and I particularly appreciated your quote of Madison when you said, that when Madison said that you do not have debates to devise institutions, but you have institutions to have a debate. Now, my point is, do institutions not influence the quality of the debate in the first place? I'm not saying Europe should abide by democratic principles, but if you say it should, do you not see a tension over here? And to push my argument to the extreme, there are many regimes across the world that impose their institutions, and in such regimes, there are no debates, for example, or there is, you know, in some regimes there is no free speech. So do you not see such a tension here, and do you not feel that it feeds into the problem in Europe at the moment? Thank you.
More reflection than answers. The Union may have some form of flexibility, but not too much. Because if you have too much flexibility, the Union dissolves itself. If it's just a gathering of people who come, debate, and then everyone does what he likes, there's no Union. It's a reason for which we must move slowly toward the use of votes into the system. At this moment, practically, the agreement or disagreement are between states, and there are practically no votes. There are some regulations of voting, but one never votes in the Council, never. And probably in the future, we must introduce the practice of voting. Suppose that on a certain subject, technical subject, you have 70% of the citizens which agree, but they agree. And then the minority, like in every political system, must accept the verdict, as long as it is, of course, a European competence. So flexibility is more, could be more a transition. And it could be used for countries typically like Britain, in fact, but there's a case also of Denmark. Denmark has some special issues very frequently, which wants to retain a sovereign rights on certain very specific points. And then you may have some flexibility. Why not? Because it cannot be the global rule of the system. The system must be provide research. Take the problem of security and justice. Interesting. The British said it's a field in which we can make progress. In the convention, the only members who opposed progress in the field of security and justice were the British. And they were adamant about it. So we cannot have at the same time a posture to say it would be very good of this and that, and to refute the way to achieve that. There was a famous case, which is the case of a European procureur. I don't know how to say this in English, procureur. John, how would you name a procureur?
Well, prosecutor. Yeah.
Yes, prosecutor. There was quite a debate. There was a strong majority in favor of a European prosecutor, and there was a absolute refusal by the British and some others. I think the Danes, probably the Swedes. So we didn't put it into the text, but it indicates that it's not possible at the same time to ask for a policy and to refuse the instrument of this policy. Well, for the Turkish entry, I will not develop this point. I think this issue has been handled terribly badly. Because it hasn't sense. And it has created a posture in which the Turkish are in a very difficult and embarrassing position. Think just of the North American continent. You have the US, you have Mexico, you have Canada. No one proposed to merge them. One. And they have good relationship, they have a free trade zone, they are trying for political cooperation and that. It's what we must have with our big neighbors. It's not possible to introduce into the system a non-European country, it is a non-European country, which will be the largest member, the poorest, and with the largest power of decisions. It doesn't make sense. And in the meantime, it's probable that the Turks, voters, will take negative positions. Because in the last election they had, it was the party of Islamic identity, not extremist, but Islamic culture or identity who gained. Why not? It's their choice, if they do. So we should have a more pragmatic approach, which is to develop cooperation, to have what we have, a free market, but it can be improved, to admit them in certain European institutions, notably the financial institutions, but to avoid, to implicate them in the purely political debate, which must be limited to the European states. So it's very clear, it is this that will happen at the end. So why to offend the Turk in the meantime and propose in proposing something which neither rationally nor politically will at the end be accepted. And the third question?
Was if I paraphrase your question, it was whether the danger is that imposing certain types of institution may in fact stifle debate and,
Influence the debate.
Influence the debate.
Well, we impose absolutely no new institutions. We reform the institutions. We make the council performing better. It's not good by itself to have a badly performing council. We propose to have a stable president for a 5-year term, renewable, so it makes it could be 10 years, which is the worldly system by now. Practically all the constitution has this. This president will have no new power. He will have the existing powers, not increasing at all, but he will have the influence of staying for a longer term. And then he will coordinate, he will remember the people what they said 2 years ago, he will put on the agenda the issue that have been decided and settled and all that. If you take the commission, we reduce the number. The number is nonsense. And the new members were wise enough to accept it. And I must say, they were brilliant, because they were demagogues of many sorts who were telling they must have one commissioner by member state. So since we will be 27, we'll be 27 commissioners, and there are only 12 or 13 tasks. So we must have 12 or 13 commissioners. The question is how to appoint them, how to rotate them in a fair way. And it's well accepted. So we do not create new constraints. We create a better functioning of the system. And you will see that with the time, such a reflection will probably gain support through experience amongst the leaders of opinion. And I guess that at the end, I say this to John, it's my final word, the text will be adopted. It will be, not now. It's too early, people are nervous, are negative, or that. But what we tried to do, which is a balanced system, adapted to our time. I will finish by that. Jefferson has an idea, very interesting, which he called generational sovereignty. He said the sovereignty do not belong to the people forever. They belong to the people for their generation. And for instance, he said the earth is put at the disposal of the living on it. So what we are doing for this generation, I mean the new one, a generation now is 25 years. So you have the generation of people born in 1925. This generation is over. You have the generation born around 1950. They are in power near the end of their time. According to Jefferson, and Jefferson used for that the calculation, which they were original people more than we are, made by Buffon on the animal species. The conclusion. And so there will be a new generation. And what we propose is for this generation, that is the generation between 2000 to 2020. And after that, there will be something else. Probably there will be more demand for direct vote by the citizens. They will want probably to elect the president. They will probably want to elect the chairman of the commission. It will come, not now. So our text, our proposal, is balanced for the time to come. And it is an improvement that will make the system function, make the system be, I wouldn't say loved, but appreciated by people, and which will create slowly a real European identity. Because the problem is there. It's not only a union of states, not only, it's a union of people. And every time I hear that people are traveling all around, that students are going from a country to another one, I'm pleased by that. Because it indicates a movement, it's gathering its speed and way. And so it's a text for this generation, your generation. There will be other texts later on, but this one, I think, will not be improved at this period of time, because we went as far as it was possible to go to find the proper mixture between what is impossible and what is necessary. Thank you. Thank you.
If you could just hold on 1 second, because Ségolène and Yves have the pleasurable task of doing the vote of thanks.
Monsieur le Président, Monsieur le Directeur, Mesdames et Messieurs, the Franco-British Student Alliance is delighted to be associated with this event. Our organization aims at bringing together the students from both sides of the channel into a unique intellectual community. In a few weeks, on the 8th of April, the students of LSE, Sciences Po, Cambridge, Oxford, HEC, and Polytechnique will be meeting to celebrate Europe and the Entente Cordiale. I'm delighted to announce that, alongside Lord Kerr, who is present today as well, Mr. Giscard d'Estaing has just accepted to be the patron of this celebration. And for this, we thank you very much. I hope, Monsieur le Président, that on this occasion, the future leaders and makers of Europe will define what and also how the future of Europe will be. We thank you for your support. We were planning to present you with a tie from the LSE, but apparently, to commemorate your passage, but apparently the communications officer liked it better and he left with it. So, with or without it, in the name of the students of the LSE, please accept, Monsieur le Président, our most sincere thanks for this very enriching lecture.
Thank you.